up, everybody? Dr. Joe Camerata here. Now, before we get into the podcast, I had a simple request, and that is if you like our podcast, go ahead and give us a rating of 5 stars. It will only take you 1 second and will really help to spread the strong word that we are talking about here every week on the Cross Continuum podcast. I know you'll enjoy the podcast, so let's get into it, and thank you very much. What is up, everybody? This is Dr. Joe Camerata with the Across the Continuum podcast, and we are introducing Diego Hidalgo to the podcast world. He is a skeptical physio and puts out fantastic, fantastic posts on Instagram. And for a while, I just couldn't imagine reading as much research as he did. And so he made a post a few weeks ago, which was like a 2024 intro. How can you be a better physical therapist or physio going forward? It had 40 points, and we decided to pick out a few points on there to talk about here. So I'm really excited, and I've been looking forward to this. So Diego, thank you for coming on, and will you tell the good folks and myself, honestly, who you are, how you got to the point you're at, and how you read so much?
Thank you, Joe, and nice to meet you. My name is Diego Hidalgo. I'm currently a physical therapist. I've been a journalist, and I'm also starting to become a philosopher, kind of. I have been practicing much, like I've been 1 year out of PT school. I'm still finding a lot of new things.
It's kind of hard to believe that it's only been a year, if I'm being honest. I mean, I've been out for 7 years, and I've read plenty of research, but I think you posted, what was it, a couple of days ago that you've logged like 2,000 papers already. Yes. since coming out of physical therapy. And I think that's one of the most challenging things about being a physical therapist, especially a busy physical therapist or a clinician in any sense, is just like finding time to stay up to date.
Absolutely.
And I mean, you and I both know how difficult it is to find continuing education as well that represents like what a body of evidence says, and if that body of evidence is, you know, kind of in the ballpark of where we would kind of feel comfortable. I know that you posted about the kind of road that you took to read all of that. Can you just like highlight it again here? Because I'm so impressed.
I think that I started reading, well, it goes back. And if I had the opportunity, because it's my first time on a podcast, I would like to explain how a skeptical physio is an account. Was born. It was during my first year, and it was kind of related to exercise science, because the first year of any degree, I think that it works or acts like a screening test, in the sense that you have all the basic subjects like biology, physiology, anatomy, physics, and along with those subjects that are like really, really evidence-based, you have the particular applied sciences that you may want to study, whether you are a chiro, a physical therapist, an osteopath. So in my case, it was the subjects that you can find in any physical therapy curricula. We're talking about electrotherapy, manual therapy. And it was, I believe that it was during my manual therapy class when we saw, fun enough, worked up like 3 exercises that were really, really strange, like, it was one was kind of like a side crunch or something like that, but I don't even remember those exercises. And that, because before, when I was a journalist, I was very interested in exercise sciences. I said, okay, this looks really, really wrong. And I became, that was, I think the first turn towards what the skeptical physio and account has become. What I did after that was checking the year of those subjects, of the bibliography of any of those subjects. And I realized that, for example, when it comes to my physiology subject, the first book that was listed was from the year 2017. And in the case of manual therapy, it was a book from 1970-something. It was, I think, the Capangi Articular Physiology book. And I said, okay, this sounds or this smells like bullshit. So that was the first one. Then I tried to create a journal club with my friends. I will send them one paper, like an editorial or something like that. I discovered that none of them would read it. So to make things a bit shorter, one day I asked a friend, hey, why are you a physical therapist? And he said, I'm a physical therapist because when I was 16, I tore my ACL and I went to treat ACL athletes. And that's my, he didn't say his mission, but he said, that's what I want to do. So I said, okay. And I sent him a paper that was by Tool 2017, the one on Jamal Leeds be clear to return to sport. And he didn't read it in 2 weeks. So I said, okay, I need to move from this kind of environment and try to build something or try to at least express my views. And that's where all the reading papers started. So what I did was I read like 3 or 4 papers and then I said, okay, I can see myself doing this for years if I have enough time. Now, that time, I started, I think, officially on the 1st of July of that year. And after that, what I did was every day I will need to read 2 papers. If one day I don't read those papers, I will need to read 4 papers the next day or find any day along during this month where I can kind of introduce or read those extra papers that I didn't read before. So, that was, I think, the most obvious thing or the easiest way to describe why I started reading papers, because I developed that sense of urgency that I talk about in one of my last posts. And it was kind of easy because it became a habit really quickly and I had that motivation, but also the flexibility to say, okay, I can do it in different ways. And for example, in the last post I did about this topic, I said that I read many papers while I'm working on my treadmill. So things are really easy when you combine those two, especially if you are a physical therapist, because you know, you want to do exercise, you want to do physical therapy in some ways. So it was really easy. After a while, I realized, I think it was in my 4th year, because here our bachelor lasts 4 years, it's not like the DPT thing. Where I said, okay, I can't keep reading those papers or at least at this rhythm anymore. So what I did was trying to listen to podcasts. So one podcast episode would last typically like 1 hour would suffice to be considered a paper. And with that mix of papers and podcasts, I ended up reaching my goal, which was like 2 papers per day multiplied by 3 years would make like, I don't know, 2,100 papers. And I believe that's the story.
It's I'm sure everybody here is glad that you've read all those papers, because the posts that you make are very informative and easy to read. And I, you know, it's totally different from how I kind of got into reading. And probably a lot of other folks get into diving into the literature, because for me, at least, there was just a disconnect between what I was experiencing and then what you learn in school and then what folks on, you know, the Instagrams are talking about. And you're like, oh, well, let me look into this sort of thing. And at some point it just kind of becomes this almost like a dirty pleasure to find the next thing that you didn't know before and figure out where that kind of fits in. Although I will say that after you read for a while, and you know, I don't know if I'm at 2,000 papers, but several hundred at least, you kind of see trends, and it almost gets a little bit boring to read the same thing over and over again, because you're like, oh, I mean, I kind of already knew this. This just adds like a whisper of information to this other piece of like the puzzle that I kind of knew before. Are you seeing that happens at all, where now that you've read a couple thousand papers, you're like, yeah, I kind of knew this already. I knew this was going to be what the paper said.
Yes, I mean, the issue with our literature is that we have low certainty to very low many times, and we can see that with systematic reviews and meta-analysis. So I think that at first, every paper changes everything for you, because, I mean, you read a paper about ACLs and you discover many things that you weren't taught during college. But after a while reading papers about the same topics, it becomes kind of repetitive, because you notice the same mistakes or the same trends, as you said. And it's like, for example, sometimes I read a paper about some a given topic, let's say ISTM, and it's the, fifth paper that I've read about the topic, and I'm like, okay, I know how is this going to end. It's like a bad movie that repeats over and over again. So that's one of the reasons why I chose to pursue not a philosophical career, but to do my current master's on philosophy. But I'm still reading. I'm just going more towards exercise sciences, as we talked 2 months ago or so. But beyond that, yes, I try to read. I'm not reading as much physical therapy papers as I used to.
Sure. I mean, what more could you know unless there's like some sort of giant breakthrough that happens, and, you know, that we learn that leg extensions aren't great for, you know, ACL rehab and getting the quad active or anything like that. So let's linger on philosophy here, because one of the points, and I pulled out a few from that post that I was talking about, talks about philosophy. And I'm just going to read a verbatim here, and you can kind of take me through it. Mm-hmm. But it says, philosophy is needed to advance our thinking too. It won't be our crush, but may become a great mentor. So when it comes to philosophy in the medical world, what needs to happen and why do we need it?
The thing with philosophy in general, going beyond the medical field, is that it's really dense, and it's usually expressed in a language that is not plain English. So what happens is that, and this happened when I was in high school too, you may read about a given philosopher, you may read about Socrates or Plato or Aristotle, and you will say half the time, what is he trying to say? So that's, I mean, the first barrier is the language. After that, and if we now go back to the medical field, I believe that it's important to grasp the different reasonings that they may try to create, because again, if we go back to the idea of a paper, philosophers would be many standard deviations beyond what the average human may have when it comes to reasoning or to their ideas, for example. The other day I was reading The Republic by Plato, and in his Republic, he would like to create, or he proposed something that today would be considered inimaginable, cruelty, a lack of total ethics, because what he noticed was that the state, a nation, a country, is the sum of its citizens, but citizens tend to group or to create their groups, and they call those groups usually friends or family. And those individuals may betray the nation in the name of the benefit of their family or their particular group. So what he realized was that the biggest enemy of the nation are the own citizens of that nation. What he proposed was, okay, what we need to do is make that no one knows their sons or daughters, so the state will take care of them, and by extension, all the nation, all the citizens of this nation, because they don't know if that kid is their son or their daughter, will take care of all of them. And now this is an extreme example of reasoning, but if we go beyond this proposition, if we try to think, okay, what's Plato really saying? What he's saying is, ideally, in a nation, if we want a nation to be successful, we would like to achieve a situation or a number of circumstances where all citizens take care of each other as if they were a big family, the big family of the state in this case. So I think that kind of extreme reasoning may be really helpful for the medical field, especially because the medical field seems kind of stuck in a really rusty situation where you are, if we go to physical therapy, we're still performing or proposing ideas that were debunked three or four decades ago. And by being exposed to those extreme examples of reasoning or these extreme examples of logic, I believe that we can advance a lot of our reasoning along with philosophy of science, which is technically the side, the branch of philosophy that I'm trying to specialize of. So if we mix both philosophy and history, you can see the past, see that we may not have changed much, and think, okay, so where do we go from here?
I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is kind of goes along with like tribalism and the idea that like research hasn't caught up with the individual experiences that clinicians are having in the moment, right? If we're thinking about something like the APTA or like maybe just the body of research in general, tends to be, 17 years ahead of where clinicians are practicing. And yet we have clinicians that are kind of within these bubbles, within these families, within these tribes that are kind of stuck in their own echo chamber and their own bubbles. And I'm, you know, myself included, and I'm sure yourself, because we have these biases that we can't really get out of, but to understand kind of that philosophy that you were talking about where it can't really work that way. And so understanding that is an extreme stance is probably a good thing to know. I mean, my experience with philosophy has not been nothing, right? I mean, I want to say that most physical therapists at some point probably bump into nihilism somewhere along the path where they're like, oh, I guess just nothing works and I just need to, you know, just be friends with this patient and they'll get better. But I've also attempted to read Nicole Piamani's stuff. Have you ever heard of her?
I follow her, but I haven't read anything from her. I've read a paper she did, but not the book.
Tried to read her book, and I think she based it off of Heidegger, and my brain could not manage to get through one or two sentences. I had to reread paragraphs multiple times, so even I just stopped reading that book. I was like, all right, I can't do this.
Heidegger is one of the... I haven't read all the philosophers, but he's for sure in my top three of philosophers that are hard to understand. So I feel you.
Very hard to understand. But again, it's kind of interesting, and I want to linger on the philosophy just a little bit longer because it kind of matters where you stick your flag, right? Where you draw the line in the sand in regard to our experience, right? Our existence, what we're perceiving, what our reality is, because that is going to dictate basically how you communicate things, how you kind of see what matters and what doesn't, right? Something might take priority based on your beliefs and your expectations of what it is that Absolutely. We're doing here yes. versus somebody else who's like, I just want to be able to get to my kid's birthday party or something like that and not be in pain. Mm-hmm. And so not that that's not important, but the philosophical differences and the belief systems that come into play, you should probably be familiar with multiple so that you're not just like blindly defending your own.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at the end, it's like when you're reading a paper and you want to know what the other side or the other sides may be thinking, because sometimes you want to understand them or their point of view, and sometimes you want to use their point of view against them in the sense of a response. So yeah, the more you know, the better usually. And that's the saying that the truth will make you free. So we don't have a truth, but probably if there's a truth, it requires to be exposed to as many different points of view or quote unquote realities as we can.
And I think that this point kind of segues nicely into one of the other points that you had made, which I'm going to read verbatim here, which is critical thinking is necessary. It is not a luxury, and we need to invest time and effort to develop it. And I actually, this one really interests me a lot because when I think of critical thinking, I think of something like, you know, system one and system two, and we have that kind of knee-jerk reaction thinking, and then that kind of slow processing where we slow an idea down and try and really pull it apart. But that doesn't really happen a lot unless there is some sort of cognitive dissonance where you're like, this doesn't make a whole lot of sense and I need to look into it, or you may be questioning yourself, which, or reflecting on whatever it is that is going on, the current topic at hand, or there's some sort of self-scrutiny that's going on. But a lot of folks don't generally wade into those areas. And so how do you use critical thinking, and why is it necessary?
Critical thinking is necessary because we live in a world that requires us to be critical about what we see and what we listen to, what we may experience as both persons and political animals. The thing with critical thinking is that it hurts a lot. And to be honest, I don't like to be wrong. That I hate to be wrong because I feel bad. I have developed, it's probably something that it's really common, but when I'm wrong, I feel bad because I realize that I've been wrong a lot of time, for a long time. And I feel as if I have spent a lot of energy, time, and effort in something, in an enterprise that ended up becoming an illusion. So the thing with physical therapy and critical thinking is that we are not rewarded to be great critical thinkers. But if, for example, we think about a physician that lacks that critical thinking ability, he would probably cause a lot of deaths. And that's one of the good and bad things about physical therapy is that nobody dies. Because nobody dies, we don't have any incentives many times to change. So that time that you spend, for example, reading papers or listening to podcasts to improve your practice may not come in anything beyond your own illusions, because you may not be paid more or be seen or considered a better physical therapist. Usually it's the opposite, because you kind of create a cognitive dissonance among your peers, and they may think that you are in the wrong because all of them may believe that X is the real thing, and you may say, okay, X is not the real thing. That's another of the points that are important to know about critical thinking, is that critical thinking usually tends to be negative in a sense, because you are criticizing something. So, of course, if you criticize something, you're going to look like the bad guy for a lot of people. And because we kind of, as I said previously with Plato analogy, because we become groups and we have shared interests, critical thinkers are not welcome probably in any place. I mean, they are like the black sheep of the family. So you probably need to avoid that. Now, why is important? Because have you ever had that feeling that you listen or read to something that you said 1 year ago and you feel kind of cringy, like, wow, this is me? Did I say that? So that's critical thinking in some sense. If you don't develop your critical thinking, you are not evolving. And if you are not evolving, you are always standing in the same place. You are kind of a stone instead of a car.
So much. I feel like there's so much to unpack right there. I mean, I like the thing you said about there's not really any positive outcome to critical thinking in the physical therapy world, and pairing that with like nobody dies, right? Mm-hmm. And it's so tough because it's pretty easy to pull on the thread of where does nocebo go? Where does kinesiophobia go down in the long term? But nobody's in physical therapy long enough, and there's so many factors that are going to contribute to somebody getting a comorbidity or declining or even dying that we can't really attribute it to that. And so it does make sense that critical thinking isn't positively rewarded in that sense, because the timetable is far too long.
Of course. And that's something that I feel a lot with my patients, because you may have patients that were told something 20 years ago about you shouldn't move, and it can so become a self-fulfilling prophecy, because it's like, okay, if you were told 20 years ago that you shouldn't lift anything beyond 1 kilo and you obey those orders, you are kind of reducing your life expectancy and kind of increasing your chance or your risk of chronic diseases just because you obeyed those orders 20 years ago. But because these things take so much time to be perceived, you will attribute those issues to other things like aging or wear and tear or
it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because of course if you are told that you should leave anything and you obey those orders for 20 years, you are going to develop some of those consequences. Now, because there's so much time between point A and point B, you are not going to attribute those consequences that you have experienced in point B to point A. And that's one of the ways we get away with murder.
Yeah, and to kind of continue down that path, it's like the critical thinking isn't rewarded because of things like natural history and regression of the mean, where folks are just going to get better. And just like you said, we misattribute their getting better to the interventions that we're providing or the narratives that we're giving them, or, you know, saying that the slippery slope isn't really leading to anything because they're usually fine afterwards. And it's, again, it's like, is the amount of time that we're measuring them being fine long enough to really see that that's the case? Like, yeah, I mean, if we tell them something today, they might not die tomorrow, but, is that not kind of creating a cascade that might not be super beneficial for them for the remainder of their life? It's like, I don't know.
Consequences, you will see them in the long run, 20, 30 years after those events. And we as physical therapists, I mean, that we have that role kind of become the bridge. Like, okay, you need to keep doing those things. I believe that one of the issues that we have is that there's kind of a hierarchy. So the word of physicians for many is the law. And if there's a conflict of advices between physical therapists and physicians, people most of the time will choose what those physicians told them.
Yeah, unfortunately, they have the medical authority figure trump card. All right, so going into the next point here, I'm just going to start from the top. The most optimal treatment program is a wolf in sheep's clothing. Adherence is the requisite for consistency, and consistency eats the optimal thing for breakfast. I mean, I love this. Please tell me why.
I think that this can be explained from two points of view. The first one being from a fitness perspective. And so, for example, we're in January, and in January we have all those New Year resolutions trying to achieve their goals, one of them being becoming more physically active, so they will flood the gyms. And sometimes those New Year resolutions are also your friends. So for many years now, I have friends who have asked me, hey, Diego, what should I do? What's the most optimal thing? Because I want to grow like crazy. I remember one friend, for example, that even before signing or arriving to the gym, said, okay, I have a bottle of creatine, a bottle of protein powder, which, I mean, both supplements are nice, but if you haven't lifted yet anything, I would prioritize the lower hanging fruit. So in that sense, what I said is, look, I recommend you to check your current volume, what you want to do in the gym, and cut it down so it becomes 1/3 of the total. Apart from that, I encourage you to not introduce much variation, just focus on those, not necessarily the basics, but those things, and try to find a bro split or something, any kind of gym routine that allows you to be consistent. So hit the gym 6 months, hit the gym 1 year before you try to become or to achieve, to look for the optimal thing, because most people live before being able to arrive to that point. And we know that during the first stage with all the newbie gains, you are going to achieve a lot just by lifting weights and discovering concepts like RPE or reaching your true failure or a full range of motion, all that stuff. Now, if we see those or that that quote, that premise from a physical therapy perspective, I think that it becomes also important because, okay, you may want your patient to do 20 exercises, but if you know that patient doesn't know how to do properly, I mean, 15 of them, or he's going to forget most of those exercises, you probably want to just stick with 3 or 4, explain them better, in a better way, explain what you want to achieve with those, and try to build some adherence to the treatment before trying to introduce out of concept. Why? Because the more variety we introduce to a system, the more chaotic it becomes. And if a system becomes too chaotic, people may want to get away from it. They may try to avoid it.
Yeah, and the thing that I try and push the most, especially with my own athletes and with the people that I teach how to coach, is like, you got to figure out what the person is going to like to do for the next, I don't know, 40 years. And that may very well change. I mean, we can't just sit here and say, all right, I'm definitely going to do powerlifting for the next 40 years. But figuring out that there's really no optimal way to do things. There are certain criteria that we want to hit that are laid out by people like the World Health Organization and, you know, the Department of Health as far as exercise goes. That's fine, but there's still no minimum effective dose when it comes to exercise that's going to be beneficial. I mean, yes, we can do things that are far under our conditioning level, and that might not add to our conditioning level like overall, but there's still going to be this drive to figure out how we can not optimize things in the moment, but keep things going for the next few decades. I mean, I have plenty of athletes who are like, how do I get this done right now? And it's just like, you can't, there's no way. We just have to continuously do this thing that you're not very good at until you basically figure out how to be better at it. Right. I mean, I just see movement as problems and continuing to show up to that problem and try and see if you can figure out a better solution is training over time. And if that's fun and you enjoy that process, then great.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a point or there's a time where you can choose the optimal and it's going to be great. But the world, and I think that that's one of the quotes that you wanted to discuss also, is more inactive than ever. We see that data constantly, and imagine that we lose 50 or 60% of the people along the way because we propose things that are too difficult for them or may require or ask them for too much of their time. Because the number one thing that patients or people in general will say to not exercise is, I don't have time for it. I mean, okay, we have the idea about priorities and all that stuff, but if they don't really have much time, and that's unfortunately one common thing that is the reality of our world, we may want to promote the minimal effective dose. And I believe that, I don't know if it's Dr. Pack who is doing his PhD on this topic, like what is the minimum effective dose to achieve the big most gains.
Yeah, I feel like I've read plenty of stuff from either Dr. Pack or Greg Knuckles, or, you know, that kind of world of exercise phys where it's like, yeah, I mean, you could probably do not a whole lot and keep things basically where they're at this point. Once you get that kind of level of conditioning, right? It doesn't have to be a lot. Folks think that there's some sort of imaginary checkpoint or criteria that, oh, I have to work out for an hour, or I have to work out, you know, 6 times a week for things to work out. It's like, well, I mean, you could just go for a walk a couple times a week, and that's better than not doing anything. And that will greatly contribute to that kind of sedentary world that you're talking about.
Yeah. And that links with another of the points that, look, I love for everyone to do resistance training and to train hard. I would love all of them to try all the sports they can. But the reality is that many of them have many things going on against their will to do those things. So sometimes enough is better than not doing the optimal thing. And we go back to the idea that many people will be in a much better place just by walking every day, half an hour or an hour, and lifting some TheraBands, unfortunately, or a 5 kilo kettlebell. So yeah, there's a time and place, and we need to try to convince all of them if it's possible. But of course, everyone chooses to live their life they want to, and we have our limits when it comes to motivational interviewing and all those things.
Yeah, I mean the biggest question is always like, how do we get somebody to change their behavior, right? How do we get somebody to adopt something that they obviously don't think is important enough to do themselves and say like, hey, this is a high importance to make sure that you get this done. And if they felt like it was very important, they probably would have been doing it already. And so we start to see like different, you know, places that people land in the trans-theoretical model of change and how ready are they? Are they even contemplating this change? I'm sure there's things that I'm not doing that I'm not even thinking about not doing because there's zero importance for me to do it. And if somebody came along and was like, hey, this is really important, I'd probably be like, I mean, I've been doing okay without it.
Absolutely. And I believe because I've been thinking about this yesterday, I was thinking, okay, why people choose to radically change something in their life? And when I think about the physical fitness world, many times, what drives people to the gym to be consistent are bad experiences, really bad experiences. So we may have people that may have, or they may consider that they are too skinny, or they may consider that they are too fat or too weak. Or we may have, for example, I'm now practicing MMA and BG, and when I talk with most of them, for example, in my MMA classes, one of our fighters started doing MMA because he was brutally attacked on the street and he felt so weak, so powerless, that he chose to change radically. So if we could achieve in a bit more friendly way, of course, that emotion, that level of feelings that are able to convince people to do those things, because we can list all the benefits that endurance or resistance training have. But if people don't want to do it, if people don't want to engage or invest their time into it because of powerful reasons, we won't achieve anything.
Yeah, you kind of hope that behavior change happens without that stark change in somebody's reality, right? Hopefully somebody doesn't have to die, or, you know, they don't have to be beat up or anything like that. But unfortunately, if folks are generally doing okay, they're like, this is fine, you know? And it's the same thing for patients, right? If you can make things easier for them, are they going to take advantage of that? Probably not. Unless they're in that part of that stage where they're like, all right, I need to make a change. That's why I'm here in physical therapy. But if they're not, I mean, if you didn't know me from anybody and I came up to you on the street and I was like, hey, you should probably, you know, start lifting weights, you'd be like, get out of here, you freak. I don't know who you are.
Yeah. And I believe that I was thinking about the Rolnick book, Motivational Interviewing, Helping People to Change, I think. He says, like, it's like the Fight Club, that quote, like the first rule of the Fight Club is that you never talk about the Fight Club. I think that something similar goes for motivational interview. Like, change needs to happen because the patient is ready for that, not because we are trying to convince them. They need to convince themselves, and we are just like a guide to help deal with the objections that they may have.
Sure. Now let's hit on the last point here, which is versatility is an underrated trait in the times of the niche. Now, again, I really like this one, which is why I picked it out. But why is versatility underrated?
The thing is that I think that currently now the meta, like when we are talking about video games, the meta now is creating your niche and having bios. I'm not criticizing this, okay? I'm just saying that it is what it is. Saying niches like I help lifters conquer their pain and achieve PRs while rehabbing. Or we have people that specializes on ACLs or on the knee or in dealing with two or three issues. So that's the niche. What I think with the niche and the need for versatility is that sometimes when we choose a niche, we are choosing a world of diminishing returns because we will learn a lot in the beginnings, but after a while, it's like when we talked before about papers, reading the same paper over and over again. So something similar may happen when you only treat a very narrow thing. So when we narrow things down to make them easier to accomplish or to become the go-to person for the specific issue, we are also, not always, but many times we are narrowing our view of what's happening. So if you only know about ACLs, you may be losing track of what's happening within the orthopedics or sports or pelvic floor world that could help you improve your practice without you knowing. For example, I made a post, I think 2 years ago, about manual drainage. And I think I only listen, I only know one person that have criticized manual drainage before. He's the lymphologist, my guy Luis Montoya. And I was like, okay, nobody's talking about this. This is a really clear issue that we can deal with, but because nobody has chosen to invest time beyond their niche in this aspect, nobody knows that this is probably something that doesn't work at all.
Yeah, it's a tough spot, and I'm not here to criticize anybody either, because you have these two kind of powerful worlds that butt up against one another, the awful decision-making process of the human versus the sales and marketing process that needs to boast clarity and have very short and nicely put together sound bites. And it is tough, but I think if you haven't read it before, the book Range by David Epstein kind of encapsulate this one's pretty nicely, where there are folks, at least in the book, he talks about people like Tiger Woods versus Roger Federer, and Tiger Woods has done the same thing since he was like 2 years old and has become an elite athlete in that thing. And whereas Roger Federer, who is also an elite tennis player, didn't start until he was like 20. But because he had such a wide breadth of kind of generalization in sport, he was able to apply all that kind of little things that he took from each and every sport to become great at tennis. And while there is a lot of criticism out of physical therapy school that they're just creating generalists, it's like, well, yeah, that's kind of the point, right?
Yeah, but I mean, again, I'm not criticizing the niche in any way. I understand the need for it. However, I think that in general, going beyond physical therapy, the society is becoming more and more niche-like, more specialized. So before you had a bachelor, before you didn't have a bachelor, you know how to do some things. After that, you were asked to have a bachelor, then master's followed, then the PhD, or for example, in physical therapy, the DPT. And we are kind of becoming better, but only at one small thing, and I call this the PhD curse, because it's something that I experienced when I was a journalist student. So, for example, journalism as a degree allows for a lot of freedom when it comes to choosing what you're going to teach. Many of my teachers chose at that time to teach their PhD thesis. So they think that it's the most important thing, because they have invested so many hours, so much effort into that really, 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 really minute thing, that they can't realize that the rest of the, in this case, the students are hating what they are being taught. And I believe that this PhD curse is also an issue of our time. And I conceive, this is of course how, this is my own conception of what we should try to become as humans, but try to become well-rounded, practice sports, but also read philosophy, but also do combat sports, and know how to play the guitar, and try to sing even if you don't sing really well. So try to become, I mean, we are humans, we have a brain, a really good one, even with all the mistakes that we commit. And I believe that it's a bit sad that we try to become the best at one thing and lose track of all the different things that reality is open to offer us.
Sure. And it does kind of feel like a almost a first world problem, or like a 21st century problem, you know, where, especially now, where it seems like, myself included, like every physical therapist is trying to figure out what's the next thing to do, because physical therapy is tanking or going under, or, you know, there's just not enough juice left to squeeze out of being just a staff physical therapist. It's like, you know, what's the next thing? So I don't know what the answer to that question is, but.
Yeah, but I mean, for example, and going with the niche, many times, we are in the physical therapy niche, also even if physical therapy encompasses a lot of things, diverse fields. If we look beyond what's happening in physical therapy, this situation is the same for many, many, many professions. I saw this also as a journalist, and I'm seeing this not as a philosopher, and I don't consider myself a philosopher, but as a student of philosophy. And I'm asking my friends, and they are saying things that match really close to what we have been talking about all the becoming the best at one thing, on the issue with trying to find the next big thing, when maybe we need to reinvent the system if we want to make the living that we want to. But of course, because there are many conflicts of interest to perpetuate the system, it becomes a really hard task.
Among many hard tasks. I have one more question for you, and it's not one that was on there, but just before we end things, because you've answered everything so beautifully. This was something that, and we were talking about before we were recording, Daniel Arbilla. He asked me this question, and we had the entire like an hour and a half conversation about it. And I want to ask it to you, but how do you define physical therapy?
I think that I define physical therapy as a number of ideas, practices, and beliefs that have always existed. And I said a while ago that I believe, I mean, what we consider now physicians or medicine is really new, but what physical therapists are doing now, many times or most of the time, are part of our DNA as humans. Because I can only imagine our forerunners, kicking a rock or falling from a promontory or something like that. They probably applied manual therapy to deal with that pain. And they found relief in it. Or maybe they realized that they could become, like the Milo of Croton, they could become stronger or bigger by lifting things, or probably they will carry, dead animals or something for a while, and they will realize that they are becoming maybe a bit stronger, or that they could run for longer because they have been running for years. So I believe that, and this is probably a very romantical idea about what physical therapy is or how I define it, but physical therapy is the first type of medicine, is the oldest one, because I imagine that even before we develop something close to what we call now a language, that is a technology, languages are technologies to understand each other, before the creation of any language, people was in some ways applying physical therapy, and that's something that for me is really powerful.
Beautifully put. Much better than I could have put it. And the only reason that I ask, and this question has interested me so much since you asked me, was it kind of depends on what, like you were talking about, what the truth is, if we can even have a truth about what we should be doing, how we should be conducting ourselves, what the goal should be, is going to kind of depend on just like the, again, like philosophy, like what's your belief system, is like, what is the system that we're kind of relating intervention and interaction and successes and failures to, because if the definition is different between groups, between practitioners, between countries, then the successes and all those definitions are going to be different. And so I don't really know the answer to that one yet. I'll have to listen to yours again multiple times.
Exactly. Yes.
Perfect, man. Well, I appreciate it. I'm glad that this was the first podcast. I'm honored, like I said before. Thank you very much for coming on. And anything else? Anything you want to tell the good people of Across Continuum podcast before we go?
Nothing much. Thanks, Joe, for having me here, because it has been a pleasure. The first time I knew about Across the Continuum was in the Modern Pain Care podcast, when you introduced yourself, I think it was in 2021. And at that time, when I listened to what you had to say, I thought, okay, that's the issue that I'm also dealing with. I believe that there's an issue when it comes to strength and conditioning in this world, in this physical therapy in our small world. And I believe I trust your mission, and I'm 100% in your niche.
Well, thank you, brother. I appreciate it. And I'll do a shameless plug, and then I'll let you do any plugs. We have our next mentored cohort coming up on February 12th. So if anybody wants to get in on that, head up to our website. Where can the people find you, Diego, if they want to follow more? There's only one spot that I could find, so tell them where it is.
Yes, and there's only that spot, I think. I mean, you can find me on Twitter as Physio Skeptical, because Skeptical Physio was already taken. And you can find me on Instagram as Skeptical Physio. But beyond those two places, I'm kind of invisible.
All right. Well, I will make sure to put those down in the description. And thanks again, man. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me here.